WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The more tasteless, the better. The more egregiously you grate on someone's nerves, the more of an impression you make. Wear your hair in a genital shape, dress in cacophonous color clashes, and you are fabulous. That's the voice of Vincent de Blasio, the publisher of an ultra-hip magazine that records the excesses of New York's party scene. De Blasio is the hero of Manhattan on the Rocks, a new novel by my guest Michael Musto, who himself records the excesses and outrageousness of New York's club scene in La Dolce Musto, his nightlife column in The Village Voice. His column also dishes the celebs attending opening parties for films and Broadway plays. His earlier book, Downtown, was a survey of New York's club scene. I asked Musto to read the opening paragraph from his novel, Manhattan on the Rocks.
They do, I watch. They dress, scream, carouse, have sex. I take notes. I am the ringleader, the mirror to their marauding, the reflection of their cavalcade. Someone swings from a chandelier, and I muster a wry smile. A woman squirts milk from her breasts at a nightclub audience, and I simply nod knowingly and involuntarily reach for my pen. I am neither over nor underwhelmed, just whelmed. I don't have sex, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't do. I watch.
Michael Musto, are you a watcher yourself?
I'm much more of a doer than the character in my book, Vinnie de Blasio.
By that you mean unlike him, you have sex?
Well, I didn't say that. But as far as the scenes that I cover, I do tend to immerse myself a lot more deeply than he does.
Uh-huh. Your previous book was a nonfiction book about the club scene in New York. What are some of the things you feel you can say in fiction that you couldn't do in a nonfiction account?
A lot of times you feel that you could tell the real story of a group of people by portraying kind of hidden glimpses into their behavior and just things they say and do that you really can't do, especially if they're your friends.
Is there an example from this book of something you would have really liked to say, but you couldn't say it until you were writing fiction?
Well, there's millions of things.
Think of one.
Just little character glimpses. Like, one character thinks of sex as work. She's sort of a party girl in the book who considers everything just a step on the social ladder or the career ladder, including sex. It's just something to do to advance herself. I mean, she's not a prostitute. She doesn't get paid for it, but she probably feels that she is getting paid for it in some way or another in terms of career advancement. And really, all the characters in the book are kind of pseudo-avant-garde. It's kind of a glimpse into the avant-garde world of New York where they're really not that bohemian. They're really kind of deep down, they're kind of yuppies, actually.
Well, a lot of people want press and therefore want you to write about them. You've even referred to press as the new drug.
Yeah. Well, we get constant warnings now to not have sex, to not do drugs. It's an era of sobriety and denial and, you know, total abstinence. So I've decided that ego has sort of become the new drug. And that can be rewarded in the form of little press mentions, little boldface items in columns like mine. And people seek it as if it's a drug. And once they get one little hit of it, they want more and more and more.
Well, an extreme example in your book, and I don't know if this actually comes from something that really happened, but someone is lying in a pool of their own vomit in their apartment. And I think the journalist walks in. And this guy lying in the pool of his vomit holds up a magazine and says, "Look, there's something about me in it."
Yeah. This did actually happen to someone.
Really?
Yeah, shocking though it may be. A friend of mine was addicted to crack. I don't mean to laugh. It sounds like I don't travel in the most elegant circles. But a friend of mine had to knock the door down to find this person in a pool of vomit pointing to his picture in details. And it was pretty appalling. But what my character in the book does before he even helps this character is look for his own picture in that issue of the magazine.
What are some of the things that people have done, some of the more extreme things, to get into your column?
Oh, well, they chase me, sometimes saying quotable things that you just know that they've rehearsed for weeks. They perform wild stunts. They offer me drugs and sex and drugs and rock and roll, I guess. They just figure the more extreme their behavior, the better chance of a mention. And that's usually true, as long as it's not clearly staged for a mention.
What was the club scene like when you started writing about it?
It was very exciting, and that was part of the reason why they started my column, was the Village Voice sensed that there was something dynamic going on in the clubs, and they wanted someone to cover it. And it was a very visually exciting scene of whereby not just club people went to clubs, but there was a mixture of all different kinds of people that don't go to clubs anymore now, but in 84 and 85 did go out every night. And so clubs like Area and the Palladium were a really exciting mixture.
It was quite a class system within the club scene, wasn't there? Like the VIPs could get into one room, and the common folk had to wait outside and see if they were picked to get in.
Yeah, well, that whole elitist thing started with Studio 54, where people would literally kill to get in. And then around the Palladium time, it went one step further, and they developed a VIP room because they decided that just getting in wasn't enough of an ego boost for people. They needed to get in one more time.
In December of 1988, you had an article in the Village Voice that was called "The Downtown Sex Scene Makes a Comeback." And you wrote, "The yearning masses who can't have the sex they want because of AIDS come together at night and combust in a mood of horny suggestiveness." What was happening then that you were referring to?
Well, when AIDS first started to make its impact, I think a lot of people assumed that sex was going to be over forever. And a lot of people just stopped having sex and didn't even act in a sexual way in nightclubs. They ceased to exude any sexuality. Whereas nightclubs used to be a place where you could get picked up. In fact, that was one of the main motivations for going out, was to look for someone. That ended all of a sudden, and clubs became this kind of Nels, very cold, asexual, sterile Nels atmosphere. But I think once people realized that AIDS wasn't going to go away any day soon, and we were going to have to live with this and deal with it, they decided to act sexually again. And a whole new group of club people called the Club Kids came along. And these are screaming teenagers who dress up and make up names for themselves and just kind of run rampant through the clubs. And they started behaving very sexually, not necessarily in unsafe ways, but just by kind of showing lots of flesh and having go-go, male and female go-go dancers every night, and having wet 'em down t-shirt contests in the clubs. And it became so sexually charged that people have almost been raped in clubs just from the heat of the moment. Of a kind of lynch mob mentality has developed a few times.
Were there different versions of the scene, the straight version and the gay version?
Well, it's all kind of melding together right now in New York. Gay and straight are mixing. Gay nightlife is hotter than ever. And once again, straight people want to be part of that gay nightlife.
You're several years older than when you started covering the club scene, so a lot of the people who were your contemporaries have kind of outgrown it, and you're still in it. So do you ever find yourself being alienated by the newer club kids who come along?
No, if anything, my contemporaries failed to keep up with the new crowd, whereas I did. Most of my contemporaries wanted to still be part of this whole thing, but were too self-satisfied and didn't try to meet new people. They were just kind of coasting on their own fabulousness. But I went out of my way to meet the new crowd and cultivate new celebrities on the scene. So though I am older than the whole batch of kids, I think I'm younger at heart than most of the people from my peer group.
You've described funerals as the parties of the 80s. And I wonder really how party people have dealt with funerals, if you actually see a different kind of funeral coming out.
Yeah, well, that was a very macabre and kind of ironic statement of mine. I didn't mean to be flip about people dying. It's just that there are a lot of funerals lately, and of course the brain-dead party crowd is treating them as just another social event. At the Andy Warhol funeral, at the memorial, rather, a lot of people got online for communion simply because Don Johnson was online for communion, and they wanted to be near Don Johnson. That was quite a travesty.
Hmm.
So it's almost become a celebrity event.
You find that very depressing?
I find it wryly amusing. I don't find anything all that depressing.
Right. The character in your new novel, who is the downtown columnist and has a whole magazine devoted to it, says that Proust suited me fine, but Robert De Niro's self-imposed weight fluctuations had an even more fascinating fixation. Does that describe you too?
In a way, I went to Columbia. The character in the book dropped out of Dartmouth. I graduated from Columbia with a major in English Lit, and I found it. I went to a public high school in Brooklyn, where we actually studied Simon and Garfunkel poetry. Okay, that was the extent of the curriculum. So then, landing at Columbia, where you had to read the Iliad and the Odyssey and about 10 other Greek and Roman classics before you even started your freshman year, was very traumatic for me. And I think I retreated from that by immersing myself in a lot of trash and reading The Inquirer and following Cher's hairdos and things. So I've always been kind of torn between being intellectual and being a piece of trash. And I've just tried to cultivate both extreme sides of my personality.
Michael Mustel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.